Chapter 3. The Great Republican Abdication. On June 15, 2015, real estate developer and reality TV star Donald Trump descended an escalator to the lobby of his own building, Trump Tower, to make an announcement. He was running for president. At the time, he was just another long-shot candidate who thought his wealth and celebrity might give him a chance, or, at the very least, allow him to bask in the spotlight for a few months. Like fellow businessman Henry Ford a century earlier, Trump held some extremist views. His most recent experience with politics had been as a birther, questioning whether President Barack Obama was born in the United States. To the extent that leading media and political figures took him seriously, it was to denounce him. But the primary system had opened up the presidential nomination process more than ever before in American history. And openness is always double-edged. In this new environment, a wider range of politicians, from George McGovern to Barack Obama, could now compete seriously for the presidency. But the window was now also open to true outsiders, individuals who had never held elective office. In the 23 years between 1945 and 1968, under the old convention system, only a single outsider, Dwight Eisenhower, publicly sought the nomination of either party. By contrast, during the first two decades of the primary system, 1972 to 1992, 8 outsiders ran, 5 Democrats and 3 Republicans. An average of 1.25 per election. And between 1996 and 2016, 18 outsiders competed in one of the two parties' primaries, an average of 3 per election. 13 of these were Republicans. The post-1972 primary system was especially vulnerable to a particular kind of outsider. Individuals with enough fame or money to skip the invisible primary. In other words, celebrities. Although conservative outsiders Pat Robertson, Pat Buchanan, and Steve Forbes did not manage to overcome the effects of the invisible primary during the 1980s and 1990s, their relative success provided clues into how it might be done. Forbes, an extraordinarily wealthy businessman, was able to buy name recognition, while Robertson, a televangelist who founded the Christian Broadcasting Network, and Buchanan, a television commentator and early Republican proponent of white nationalism, were both colorful figures with special media access. Although none of them won the nomination, they used massive wealth and celebrity status to become contenders. But in the end, celebrity outsiders had always fallen short. And so, on that early summer afternoon in the gilded lobby of Trump Tower, there seemed no reason to think things would be different. To win the nomination, Trump would have to compete in an intricate web of caucuses and primaries against 16 other candidates. Many of his rivals boasted the kind of resume that had been the hallmark of successful candidates in the past. At the head of the pack was Florida Governor Jeb Bush, son and brother of former presidents. There were other governors as well, including Wisconsin's Scott Walker, Louisiana's Bobby Jindal, New Jersey's Chris Christie, and Ohio's John Kasich, and several rising Republican stars, younger, media-savvy politicians such as Senators Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, who hoped to replicate Barack Obama's fast track to the presidency. Texas, home to 3 of the last 8 elected presidents, offered 2 more candidates, Senator Ted Cruz and former Governor Rick Perry. Besides Trump, 2 other outsiders threw their hats into the ring, businesswoman Carly Fiorina and neurosurgeon Ben Carson. Trump could not hope to win the support of the establishment. Not only did he lack any political experience, but he wasn't even a lifelong Republican. Whereas Bush, Rubio, Cruz, Christie, Walker, and Kasich all had deep Republican roots, Trump had switched his party registration several times and had even contributed to Hillary Clinton's campaign for the U.S. Senate. Even after Trump began to surge in the polls, few people took his candidacy seriously. In August 2015, 2 months after Trump declared his candidacy, Las Vegas bookmakers gave him 100-to-1 odds of winning the White House. And in November 2015, as Trump sat high atop the Republican polls, Nate Silver, founder of the 538 blog, whose uncannily accurate predictions in the 2008 and 2012 elections had earned him fame and prestige, wrote an article titled, "Dear Media, Stop Freaking Out About Donald Trump's Poll Numbers." The article predicted that Trump's weakness among party insiders would spell his demise. Despite Trump's seemingly large lead, Silver assured us, his chances of winning the nomination were considerably less than 20%. But the world had changed. Party gatekeepers were shells of what they once were, for two main reasons. One was a dramatic increase in the availability of outside money, accelerated, though hardly caused, by the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling. Now even marginal presidential candidates, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, Howard Dean, Bernie Sanders, could raise large sums of money, either by finding their own billionaire financier or through small donations via the internet. The proliferation of well-funded primary candidates indicated a more open and fluid political environment. The other major factor diminishing the power of traditional gatekeepers was the explosion of alternative media, particularly cable news and social media. Whereas the path to national name recognition once ran through relatively few mainstream channels, which favored establishment politicians over extremists, the new media environment made it easier for celebrities to achieve wide name recognition and public support practically overnight. This was particularly true on the Republican side, where the emergence of Fox News and influential radio talk show personalities, what political commentator David Frum calls the conservative entertainment complex, radicalized conservative voters to the benefit of ideologically extreme candidates. This gave rise to such phenomena as Herman Cain, the former Godfather Pizza CEO and radio talk show host, who rocketed to the top of the Republican polls in late 2011 before flaming out because of scandal. The nomination process was now wide open. While the rules of the game hardly guaranteed the rise of a Trump-like figure, they could no longer prevent it either. It was like a game of Russian roulette. The chances of an extremist outsider capturing the presidential nomination were higher than ever before in history. Although many factors contributed to Donald Trump's stunning political success, his rise to the presidency is, in good measure, a story of ineffective gatekeeping. Party gatekeepers failed at three key junctures: the invisible primary, the primaries themselves, and the general election. Trump finished dead last in the invisible primary. When the actual primary season began on February 1, 2016, the day of the Iowa caucus, he had no endorsements among Republican power brokers. Measured by the backing of governors, U.S. senators, and congressional representatives at the time of the Iowa caucus, Jeb Bush won the invisible primary with 31 endorsements. Marco Rubio finished second with 27. Ted Cruz finished third with 18, followed by Rand Paul with 11. Chris Christie, John Kasich, Mike Huckabee, Scott Walker, Rick Perry, and Carly Fiorina all won more endorsements than Trump. By all standard wisdom, then, Trump's candidacy was a non-starter. If history were any guide, his lead in the polls would inevitably fade. Trump's performance in the first state contest, Iowa, 24%, good for second place, did little to alter these expectations. After all, outsiders Pat Robertson, 25% of the vote in 1988, Pat Buchanan, 23% in 1996, and Steve Forbes, 31% in 2000, had all finished second in Iowa, but faded away soon thereafter. Then Trump did something no previous outsider had done. He easily won subsequent primaries in New Hampshire and South Carolina. Still, he was shunned by the party establishment. On the day of the South Carolina primary, Trump did not yet have a single endorsement from a sitting Republican governor, senator, or congressperson. It was only after winning South Carolina that Trump gained his first supporters, congressional backbenchers Duncan Hunter, California, and Chris Collins, New York. Even as he proceeded to rout his Republican rivals at the polling stations, Trump never gained a substantial number of endorsements. When the primary season ended, he had 46, less than a third of Marco Rubio's total, and barely as many as the long-ended Bush campaign. By the time Trump rolled to victory in the March 1st Super Tuesday primaries, it was clear that he had laid waste to the invisible primary, rendering it irrelevant. Undoubtedly, Trump's celebrity status played a role, but equally important was the changed media landscape. From early on in the campaign, Trump had the sympathy or support of right-wing media personalities such as Sean Hannity, Ann Coulter, Mark Levin, and Michael Savage, as well as the increasingly influential Breitbart News. Although Trump initially had a contentious relationship with Fox News, he reaped the benefits of its polarized media landscape. Trump also found new ways to use old media as a substitute for party endorsements and traditional campaign spending. A candidate with qualities uniquely tailored to the digital age, Trump attracted free mainstream coverage by creating controversy. By one estimate, the Twitter accounts of MSNBC, CNN, CBS, and NBC, four outlets that no one could accuse of pro-Trump leanings, mentioned Trump twice as often as his general election rival, Hillary Clinton. According to another study, Trump enjoyed up to $2 billion in free media coverage during the primary season. As the undisputed frontrunner in free mainstream coverage and the favorite son of much of the alternative right-wing media network, Trump did not need traditional Republican power brokers. The gatekeepers of the invisible primary were not merely invisible. By 2016, they had left the building entirely. After Trump's Super Tuesday victories, panic set in among the Republican establishment. Prominent insiders and conservative opinion leaders began to make the case against Trump. In March 2016, former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney gave a high-profile speech at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, in which he described Trump as a danger to both the Republican Party and the country. Echoing Ronald Reagan's 1964 A Time for Choosing speech, Romney declared that Trump was a fraud who had neither the temperament nor the judgment to be president. Other party elders, including 2008 presidential candidate John McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham, warned against Trump. And leading conservative publications, including the National Review and the Weekly Standard, rejected Trump in blistering terms. But the Never Trump movement was always more talk than action. In reality, the primary system had left Republican leaders virtually weaponless to halt Trump's rise. The barrage of attacks had little impact and possibly even backfired where it counted, the voting booth. Republican leaders' toothlessness was on display at the July 2016 Republican National Convention in Cleveland. In the lead-up to the convention, there was much talk of a deadlocked vote, of convincing committed delegates to cast their support to another candidate. In late June, a group called Delegates Unbound began to air national television advertisements telling Republican delegates that they were not, strictly speaking, legally bound to Trump and urging them to abandon him. Groups such as Free the Delegates, Courageous Conservatives, and Save Our Party led a campaign for the Republican National Committee's 112-member rules panel to modify the rules binding delegates to candidates, freeing delegates to vote as they had before the 1972 reforms. All these efforts came to naught. They, indeed, never had a chance. The idea that the nomination could be wrested from Trump at the convention was pure wishful thinking. In the primary-based system we now have, votes confer a legitimacy that cannot easily be circumvented or ignored, and Donald Trump had the votes, nearly 14 million of them. As Cindy Costa, a Republican National Committee member from South Carolina, put it, Trump won it fair and square. To hand the nomination to anyone else would have created magnificent chaos. Republican leaders were forced to face reality. They no longer held the keys to their party's presidential nomination. As the battleground shifted to the general election, it became clear that this was no ordinary race. Quite simply, Donald Trump was no ordinary candidate. Not only was he uniquely inexperienced, no U.S. president who was not a successful general had ever been elected without having held an elective office or a cabinet post, but his demagoguery, extremist views on immigrants and Muslims, willingness to violate basic norms of civility, and praise for Vladimir Putin and other dictators generated unease in much of the media and the political establishment. Had Republicans nominated a would-be dictator? It was impossible to know for certain. Many Republicans latched on to the saying that, whereas Trump's critics took him literally but not seriously, his supporters took him seriously but not literally. His campaign rhetoric, in this view, was mere words. There is always uncertainty over how a politician with no track record will behave in office, but as we noted earlier, anti-democratic leaders are often identifiable before they come to power. Trump, even before his inauguration, tested positive on all four measures on our litmus test for autocrats. The first sign is a weak commitment to the democratic rules of the game. Trump met this measure when he questioned the legitimacy of the electoral process and made the unprecedented suggestion that he might not accept the results of the 2016 election. Levels of voter fraud in the United States are very low, and because elections are administered by state and local governments, it is effectively impossible to coordinate national-level voting fraud. Yet, throughout the 2016 campaign, Trump insisted that millions of illegal immigrants and dead people on the voting rolls would be mobilized to vote for Clinton. For months, his campaign website declared, "Help me stop Crooked Hillary from rigging this election." In August, Trump told Sean Hannity, "We'd better be careful because that election is going to be rigged. I hope the Republicans are watching closely or it's going to be taken away from us." In October, he tweeted, "Of course there is large-scale voter fraud happening on and before Election Day." During the final presidential debate, Trump refused to say he would accept the results of the election if he were defeated. According to historian Douglas Brinkley, no major presidential candidate had cast such doubt on the democratic system since 1860. Only in the run-up to the Civil War did we see major politicians delegitimizing the federal government in this way. As Brinkley put it, that's a secessionist revolutionary motif. That's someone trying to topple the apple cart entirely. And Trump's words mattered. A lot. A Politico Morning Consult poll, carried out in mid-October, found that 41% of Americans and 73% of Republicans believed that the election could be stolen from Trump. In other words, 3 out of 4 Republicans were no longer certain that they were living under a democratic system with free elections. The second category in our litmus test is the denial of the legitimacy of one's opponents. Authoritarian politicians cast their rivals as criminal, subversive, unpatriotic, or a threat to national security or the existing way of life. Trump met this criterion as well. For one, he had been a birther, challenging the legitimacy of Barack Obama's presidency by suggesting that he was born in Kenya and that he was a Muslim, which many of his supporters equated with being un-American. During the 2016 campaign, Trump denied Hillary Clinton's legitimacy as a rival by branding her a criminal and declaring repeatedly that she has to go to jail. At campaign rallies, he applauded supporters who chanted, "Lock her up." The third criterion is toleration or encouragement of violence. Partisan violence is very often a precursor of democratic breakdown. Prominent examples include the black shirts in Italy, the brown shirts in Germany, the emergence of leftist guerrillas in Uruguay, and the rise of right and left-wing paramilitary groups in early 1960s Brazil. In the last century, no major party presidential candidate has ever endorsed violence. George Wallace did in 1968, but he was a third-party candidate. Trump broke this pattern. During the campaign, Trump not only tolerated violence among his supporters, but at times appeared to revel in it. In a radical break with established norms of civility, Trump embraced and even encouraged supporters who physically assaulted protesters. He offered to pay the legal fees of a supporter who sucker-punched and threatened to kill a protester at a rally in Fayetteville, North Carolina. On other occasions, he responded to protesters at his rallies by inciting violence among his supporters. Here are a few examples, compiled by Vox. "If you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously, just knock the hell out of them. I promise you I will pay the legal fees. I promise." February 1st, 2016, Iowa. "I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. It's true. I'd like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you." February 22, 2016, Nevada. "In the good old days, they'd rip him out of that seat so fast, but today, everybody's politically correct. Our country's going to hell with being politically correct." February 26, 2016, Oklahoma. "Get out of here. Get out. Out. This is amazing. So much fun. I love it. I love it. We having a good time? USA. 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 All right. Get him out. Try not to hurt him. If you do, I'll defend you in court. Don't worry about it." "We had four guys. They jumped on him. They were swinging and swinging. The next day we got killed in the press that we were too rough. Give me a break, you know? Right? We don't want to be too politically correct anymore. Right, folks?" March 4th, 2016, Michigan. "We had some people, some rough guys like we have right in here, and they started punching back. It was a beautiful thing. I mean, they started punching back. In the good old days, this doesn't happen, because they used to treat them very, very rough. And when they protested once, you know, they would not do it so easily again. But today they walk in and they put their hand up and put the wrong finger in the air at everybody, and they get away with murder, because we've become weak." March 9th, 2016, North Carolina. In August 2016, Trump issued a veiled endorsement of violence against Hillary Clinton, telling supporters at a Wilmington, North Carolina rally that a Clinton appointee to the Supreme Court could result in the abolition of the right to bear arms. He went on to say, "If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although, the Second Amendment people, maybe there is. I don't know. The final warning sign is a readiness to curtail the civil liberties of rivals and critics. One thing that separates contemporary autocrats from democratic leaders is their intolerance of criticism and their readiness to use their power to punish those in the opposition, media, or civil society who criticize them. Donald Trump displayed such a readiness in 2016. He said he planned to arrange for a special prosecutor to investigate Hillary Clinton after the election, and declared that Clinton should be imprisoned. Trump also repeatedly threatened to punish unfriendly media. At a rally in Fort Worth, Texas, for example, he attacked Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos, declaring, "If I become president, oh, do they have problems. They are going to have such problems." Describing the media as among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever met, Trump declared, "I'm going to open up our libel laws, so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. So that when the New York Times writes a hit piece, which is a total disgrace, or when the Washington Post writes a hit piece, we can sue them." With the exception of Richard Nixon, no major party presidential candidate met even one of these four criteria over the last century. Donald Trump met them all. No other major presidential candidate in modern U.S. history, including Nixon, has demonstrated such a weak public commitment to constitutional rights and democratic norms. Trump was precisely the kind of figure that had haunted Hamilton and other founders when they created the American presidency. Donald Trump and the four key indicators of authoritarian behavior. Rejection of, or weak commitment to, democratic rules of the game. Do they attempt to undermine the legitimacy of elections, for example, by refusing to accept credible electoral results? Trump does. Denial of the legitimacy of political opponents. Do they baselessly describe their partisan rivals as criminals whose supposed violation of the law, or potential to do so, disqualifies them from full participation in the political arena? Trump does. Toleration or encouragement of violence. Have they tacitly endorsed violence by their supporters by refusing to unambiguously condemn it and punish it? Trump has. Have they praised or refused to condemn other significant acts of political violence, either in the past or elsewhere in the world? Trump has. Readiness to curtail civil liberties of opponents, including media. Have they supported laws or policies that restrict civil liberties, such as expanded libel or defamation laws, or laws restricting protest, criticism of the government, or certain civic or political organizations? Trump has. Have they threatened to take legal or other punitive action against critics in rival parties, civil society, or the media? Trump has. Have they praised repressive measures taken by other governments, either in the past or elsewhere in the world? Trump has. This all should have set off alarm bells. The primary process had failed in its gatekeeping role and allowed a man unfit for office to run as a mainstream party candidate. But how could Republicans respond at this stage? Recall the lessons of democratic breakdowns in Europe in the 1930s and South America in the 1960s and 1970s. When gatekeeping institutions fail, mainstream politicians must do everything possible to keep dangerous figures away from the centers of power. Collective abdication, the transfer of authority to a leader who threatens democracy, usually flows from one of two sources. The first is the misguided belief that an authoritarian can be controlled or tamed. The second is what sociologist Ivan Ermakov calls ideological collusion, in which the authoritarian's agenda overlaps sufficiently with that of mainstream politicians that abdication is desirable, or at least preferable to the alternatives. But when faced with a would-be authoritarian, establishment politicians must unambiguously reject him or her and do everything possible to defend democratic institutions, even if that means temporarily joining forces with bitter rivals. For Republicans entering the general election of 2016, the implications were clear. If Trump threatened basic democratic principles, they had to stop him. To do anything else would put democracy at risk, and losing democracy is far worse than losing an election. This meant doing what was, to many, the unthinkable: backing Hillary Clinton for president. The United States has a two-party system. Only two candidates stood a chance to win the 2016 election, and one of them was a demagogue. For Republicans, it tested their political courage. Would they accept short-term political sacrifice for the good of the country? As we showed earlier, there is a precedent for such behavior. In 2016, Austrian conservatives backed Green Party candidate Alexander Van der Bellen to prevent the election of far-right radical Norbert Hofer. And in 2017, defeated French conservative candidate François Fillon called on his partisans to vote for center-left candidate Emmanuel Macron to keep far-right candidate Marine Le Pen out of power. In both these cases, right-wing politicians endorsed ideological rivals, angering much of the party base, but redirecting substantial numbers of their voters to keep extremists out of power. Some Republicans did endorse Hillary Clinton on the grounds that Donald Trump was dangerously unfit for office. Like their Austrian and French conservative counterparts, they deemed it vitally important to put their partisan interests aside out of a shared commitment to democracy. Here is what three of them said. Republican 1. Our choice this election could not be more clear. Hillary Clinton is a strong and clear supporter of American democracy interests. Donald Trump is a danger for our democracy. Republican 2. It's time to put country before party and vote for Secretary Clinton. Trump is too dangerous and too unfit to hold our nation's highest office. Republican 3. This is serious stuff, and I won't waste my vote on a protest candidate. Since the future of the country may depend on preventing Donald Trump from becoming president, I'm with her, Clinton, this November, and I urge Republicans to join me. Had these statements been made by House Speaker Paul Ryan, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and former President George W. Bush, or perhaps a trio of such prominent senators as John McCain, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz, the course of the 2016 election would have changed dramatically. Alas, they were made by William Pierce, the former press secretary of retired Maine Senator Olympia Snowe, Republican 1, Jack McGregor, a former state senator from Pennsylvania, Republican 2, and Rick Stoddard, a Republican banker in Denver, Republican 3. Leading national Republican politicians such as Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz endorsed Donald Trump. The only Republican figures of any prominence who endorsed Hillary Clinton were retired politicians or former government officials, people who were not planning to compete in future elections, who politically had nothing to lose. On the eve of the election, The Washington Post published a list of 78 Republicans who publicly endorsed Clinton. Only one of them, Congressman Richard Hanna of New York, was an elected official. And he was retiring. No Republican governors were listed, no senators, and only one retiring, member of Congress. A handful of active Republican leaders, including Senators McCain, Mark Kirk, Susan Collins, Kelly Ayotte, Mike Lee, Lisa Murkowski, and Ben Sasse, Governors John Kasich and Charlie Baker, and former Governors Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney, refused to endorse Trump. Former President George W. Bush remained silent. None of them, however, was willing to endorse Clinton. In short, most Republican leaders ended up holding the party line. If they had broken decisively with Trump, telling Americans loudly and clearly that he posed a threat to our country's cherished institutions, and if on those grounds they had endorsed Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump might never have ascended to the presidency. In France, it is estimated that half of François Fillon's conservative Republican Party voters followed his surprising endorsement of Macron. About another third abstained, leaving around a sixth of Fillon supporters who went for Le Pen, arguably making a key difference in that country's election. In the United States, we have no way of knowing how Republican voters would have split. Some, perhaps even most, of the base might still have voted for Trump, but enough would have been swayed by the image of both parties uniting to ensure Trump's defeat. What happened, tragically, was very different. Despite their hemming and hawing, most Republican leaders closed ranks behind Trump, creating the image of a unified party. That, in turn, normalized the election. Rather than a moment of crisis, the election became a standard two-party race, with Republicans backing the Republican candidate and Democrats backing the Democratic candidate. That shift proved highly consequential. Once the election became a normal race, it was essentially a toss-up for two reasons. First, intensifying partisan polarization had hardened the electorate in recent years. Not only was the country increasingly sorted into Republicans and Democrats, with few truly independent or swing voters, but Republicans and Democrats had grown increasingly loyal to their party and hostile to the other one. Voters became less movable, making the kind of landslide election that we saw in 1964 or 1972 far less likely. No matter who the candidates were in the 2000s, presidential elections were close. Second, given the uneven state of the economy and President Obama's middling approval ratings, nearly all political science models predicted a tight election. Most of them forecast a narrow Clinton victory in the popular vote, but some predicted a narrow Trump win. In any case, the models converged in predicting a close race. Toss-up elections can go either way. They hinge on contingent events, on the accidents of history. In this context, October surprises can weigh heavily. So when a newly surfaced video paints one candidate in a negative light, or a letter from the FBI director casts doubt on the other candidate's trustworthiness, it can make all the difference. Had Republican leaders publicly opposed Trump, the tightly contested red versus blue dynamics of the previous four elections would have been disrupted. The Republican electorate would have split, some heeding the warnings of the party leadership and others sticking with Trump. Still, Trump's defeat would have required the defection of only a tiny fraction of Republican voters. Instead, the election was normalized, the race narrowed, and Trump won.